Thanks very much, Kanya Mutty. Hello everyone again. So I'm Devon, if you haven't met me before, and this is the fourth of a series of four talks I've been giving on Sangha Night on the theme of discourses from the Pali Canon, which, just in brief, is an opportunity for me to sort of unpack this Buddhist language you might hear about discourses or sutras, as Pranyamati said, and Pali Canon. What we're talking about is short teachings that have been preserved from the time of the Buddha, or at least early Buddhism, in the Pali language, which is an ancient Indian language. And these teachings were collected into what's known as the Pali Canon, which is basically the only surviving complete collection of early Buddhist teachings or scriptures, in brief. So what I've been doing is each week presenting an introduction to a short discourse going back to the Buddha. And this week we come to the fire sermon. This is traditionally the Buddha's third sermon. So I'm letting you know all that. I can't really summarise the last 3 weeks. So if you haven't been to the previous 3 weeks, just absorb whatever you can. Actually, all these discourses are more or less, they work on their own, and at the same time they relate to everything else. So in a way, one never stops exploring the interconnections. So, yes, we'll be looking at the discourse itself in a minute, but this week I thought I'd give a little introduction before I handed out the translation. So, we owe the translation of the title of the discourse, known as the Fire Sermon, to the American translator Henry Clark Warren, whose Buddhism in Translations was one of those pioneering Victorian works that introduced Buddhism into the West. These Victorian scholars managed to learn Pali and Sanskrit when no other Westerner even knew these languages, and then had a go at translating Pali and Sanskrit literature into English. And the results were amazing, really. They're the kinds of thing that, for instance, our teacher Sangharakshita used in accessing the Buddha's teaching. These days we've got more reliable translations, but they've built on those earlier ones. Now, someone who read Warren's translation of early Buddhist texts was the poet T.S. Eliot, who in fact studied Sanskrit in Harvard from 1911 to 1914, where Warren had been a professor, though he'd already died. And Eliot's reading of Warren's translation resulted in Eliot naming the third section of his poem, The Wasteland, the Fire Sermon. So in this discourse we're going to look at tonight has become kind of included in one of the great works of 20th century poetry. I'm sure the Buddha could never have guessed that he'd get quoted in modernist literature. So I'll come back to that, like what exactly Eliot saw in it and how the sermon gets used, because it kind of fits, but we have to learn a bit to start with. So this title, The Fire Sermon, has got a great ring to it. Literally the title translates to something like the discourse about what is on fire, or just burning. So last week we saw that the so-called second sermon of the Buddha is a bit more like a Socratic dialogue between the Buddha and his followers than a sermon. But this discourse on burning that we'll meet tonight is a bit more like a sermon, actually, more like a teaching of the Buddha. But then the problem with this English word sermon is it's got a connotation of being a sort of tedious, long talk in a church. But of course, all the Buddhist discourses were delivered out of doors. So they weren't sermons in that sense. But they're all records of the Buddha's attempt to get across his awakening experience quite directly, to the extent that it could be put into words. And so, in a way, another problem with the word sermon is that the idea of a sermon doesn't quite get across how these early Buddhist discourses work. The Buddhist teachings were always delivered to specific people or groups. They're always tailored to the audience's interests or expectations. The Dharma was never primarily a list of doctrines or lists, but rather all those doctrines and lists, they became sort of established in time as sort of ways that the Buddha's teaching experience settled into certain forms that worked in his day, you could say, as he was talking to specific kinds of people over a very long period. So once again, I invite you to consider early Buddhist discourses as literature. It's a temptation to think of them as a more or less accurate record of what the Buddha said in ancient India. But actually that's not very plausible, in that they're more like the way the early Buddhists, after the time of the Buddha, tried to recreate the Buddha's teaching in a literary form, in a way that could be easily memorised, hence they're very repetitive. They try to recreate the Buddha's style, as it were. And this involved the development of stories. Here's an aspect of literature that is that's rather beautiful or fascinating even. The development of stories that look like historical accounts, but when you think about them, are really more like reconstructions in the form of a story of what might have happened. I suppose a good story is always what might have happened. And one of these stories is what the Buddha did after his awakening experience. In fact, it's a long and detailed story, and it's preserved in the Vinaya, which is the book of monastic discipline. It's a kind of preliminary or prologue to the stories of how the Buddha established certain rules for the monks and nuns. As the Buddha met certain people, it became necessary to think up certain rules, but we're not going to get into that. We've already come across two episodes from this long story. The first one was the Buddha giving his first sermon to his former five companions, the people he'd practiced asceticism with before he became awakened. And that was given in the deer park at Sarnath. And then there was a second sermon, which we listened to last week, we studied last week, which is more like a Socratic dialogue, through giving which the Buddha brought these five former companions to the same awakening that he'd come to. So they became the first five awakened disciples. So that's where we left the story last week, as it were. So to introduce us to the third sermon, here's a summary version of what happens next. So firstly, we hear about a spoiled young man called Yasa, who becomes disgusted with his superficial lifestyle, whom the Buddha converts to his Dharma, in a story that actually is later switched to the Buddha himself. We hear about the Buddha being a prince who becomes disgusted with his hedonistic lifestyle. So originally this was Yasa, someone else. So having converted him, and then some other people, we hear that in the end there was 60 arahants. So in the first few weeks after the Buddha's awakening. And at this point the Buddha sends them out in all directions, exhorting them to wander for the well-being and happiness of the many out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being and happiness of gods and human beings. So you couldn't get a more vivid sense of how the Buddha's teaching was not just about people's individual awakening, but about a life dedicated to helping all beings, which later becomes the Bodhisattva ideal. Then the Buddha wanders eastwards in northern India, back towards Uruvela, where actually he gained awakening. So he's heading back where he came from. There's no explanation, of course, it's just the story. On the way, he meets a group of 30 young men with their 29 young wives. The girlfriend of the unmarried man has stolen their stuff. And so they're looking for him. And the Buddha asks them, "Which is better for you?" he asks. "Seeking a woman or seeking for yourself?" He converts them too. They're crazy stories, aren't they? In the early discourses. Maybe he did meet a group of people, who knows? And funnily enough, you might think, though, well, hang on, last week he said that when you look for yourself, you can't find it. But here, he's asking all these young people whether it's best to, isn't it better to look for yourself? Which kind of suggests that there was a culture in which seeking for the self was highly regarded. I think that's the point. There's a cultural context. So, having converted all that lot, he arrives at Uruvela and he meets three fire-worshipping, dreadlocked ascetics. Isn't that just a great image? Imagine the dreadlocks. I mean, it's like he's wandered into the festival, isn't it? And he's met some of the more flamboyant characters there. They're all called, all three of them are called Kasapa, by the way. You couldn't make it up, could you? And they've got 1,000 followers, all fire-worshipping ascetics. Now, the Buddha performs a series of miracles, starting with the taming of a fierce naga, which here means python, who lives in one of the fire huts of these fire-worshipping ascetics. He has to do quite a lot of miracles, actually, to convince this lot, these three Kasapas, that he's the real thing. But he manages it, funnily enough. It's a Buddhist text. And having done that, so he's converted these three Kasapas and all their followers. So now he gives the third sermon to the former fire-worshipping ascetics. I thought, it's such good stories, I thought I'd fill you in. So I think there's exactly the right number of handouts. So you can see on this handout, the discourse itself is a bit shorter than the previous ones. So to take up two sides in a paper efficient way, I've included some other things which will help us. So I've included at the beginning the stories I just told you. So do hold on to these handouts. Do them as you wish. It's for you to keep. I think there's one behind. So I'll read out the discourse, and then you can think about it. At one time, the Blessed One was living at Gaya, at Gaya Head, with 1,000 monks. There he addressed the monks as follows. Monks, everything is burning. And what is the everything that is burning? The eye, monks, is burning. Visual forms are burning. Consciousness based on the eye is burning. Contact involving the eye is burning. And whatever experience arises from contact involving the eye as its causal basis, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that too is burning. With what is it burning? Burning with the fire of compulsion, burning with the fire of hostility, burning with the fire of confusion, burning with birth, with aging and death. I say it is burning with grief, sorrow, pain, misery and distress. Doesn't hold back, does he? The ear, monks, is burning. Sounds are burning. Dot, dot, dot. That means repeat as in the first. It's a repetition of exactly the same list of things that are burning. The nose, monks, is burning. Smells are burning. The tongue, monks, is burning. Tastes are burning. The body is burning. Tangibles are burning. The mind, monks, is burning. Ideas are burning. Consciousness based on the mind is burning. Contact involving the mind is burning. And whatever experience arises from contact involving the mind as its causal basis, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that too is burning. With what is it burning? Burning with the fire of compulsion, burning with the fire of hostility, burning with the fire of confusion, burning with birth, with aging and death. I say it is burning with grief, sorrow, pain, misery and distress. Seeing in this way, monks, the informed noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye, becomes disenchanted with visual forms, becomes disenchanted with consciousness based on the eye, becomes disenchanted with contact involving the eye, and whatever experiences arises from contact involving the eye as its causal basis, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, one becomes disenchanted with that. Seeing in this way, monks, the informed noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the ear, with sounds, becomes disenchanted with the nose, with smells, becomes disenchanted with the tongue, with tastes, becomes disenchanted with the body, with tangibles, becomes disenchanted with the mind, with mental objects. Disenchanted, one becomes self-possessed. Being self-possessed, one is liberated. Being liberated, one knows that one is liberated, and one directly knows that birth is destroyed, the spiritual life has been lived. What was to be done has to be done, and that there is nothing further than this state. This is what the Blessed One said. The monks rejoiced, delighted with the Blessed One's utterance. And while this sermon was being delivered, the hearts of the 1,000 monks were liberated from the pollutants through non-clinging. And that last bit is early Buddhist way of saying they became awakened. So there's a happy ending, basically. All these discourses have a happy ending. So this one's quite short. Can I again say that if you have any questions, or if anything is, if I say anything, or you hear something that you just don't quite understand, or it sounds very strange and mysterious, just ask a question.
I don't really understand any of it very much.
That's a point rather than a question, isn't it? Were you here in the first week?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, is the Buddha saying that all of our experience is suffering? Is that what you say? Or if our experience arises from ignorance, hatred, and craving, and therefore it is, although we are attached to it because it's temporarily beautiful, some of us, it is actually
Well, it wouldn't be entirely wrong to say that some of that is what the Buddha was getting at. But in another way, the way these early discourses work is that they offer this kind of intensely repetitious formulas as themes for meditation. And in a way, there's a lot of depth there that one needs to sort of explore step by step in order to see exactly what's being got at. So at first reading or listening, this, as you say, this can be a bit baffling. What on earth is being said? It sounds vaguely like the Buddha saying everything's suffering and it will be good to let go of that. Yeah? But the details are going to really count here, aren't they? And so that's what I intend to go on to try and unpick a bit, exactly what's being got at. Of course, you do.
The line, disenchanted, he becomes dispossessed.
Yeah.
Could you just sort of unpack that a bit for me? That's kind of... What do we infer from the term self-possession?
Well... We had it last week, actually, and I said it's a translation for virago, which usually gets translated dispassion. So becoming a noble disciple who's disenchanted becomes dispassionate is the usual translation, but which means no longer passionately engaged with what previously they had been. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I thought to talk about dispassion can make it sound like that this noble follower is no longer emotionally engaged with what's happening. I don't think that's the point. So I tried out self-possession as the way to evoke the sense of recollectedness and presence, but without being caught up in what's happening. Does that work?
Yeah.
I think recollected and present works better.
Yeah.
Sorry, say that again?
I think recollected and present works better than self-possessed.
Yeah, I'm just noticing myself feeling a bit confused about that translation. Well, also good. Yeah, it sounds a bit like sort of self-absorbed, only interested in oneself.
Self-possessed.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there's also connotations with possessed as being like something from the outside as kind of got inside me and made me into a devil or whatever.
Yeah, obviously we don't mean that. No.
On a sort of similar, the word disenchanted as it's used here, to me that word has it has its literal meaning, the opposite of being enchanted. It also has a more colloquial meaning of sort of uninterested.
Yeah.
And or almost aversive. You know, I was disenchanted with the film at the cinema, meaning I didn't really like it.
Right.
Sort of use of the
yeah,
word.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering both what is the underlying Pali word.
Yeah.
And sort of what, how should we take it in this context?
Yeah. Yeah, just going back to self-possession, I took it that when you say somebody's self-possessed, that means they're kind of present. They're not easily swayed, as it were. They know what they think. They're emotionally present.
More like the owner of your own karma, sort of, type, you know, kind of.
Not particularly. I just thought of self-possession as just as an English expression to suggest somebody who is altogether there. They know who they are and what they think, rather than having anything to do with karma. Yeah, but it's really important that. You know that these translations are attempts to get across words that are in another language, in a way. And it's often useful to know different alternatives, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like dispassion or present and emotionally present or something. The word disenchantment translates nibbida in Pali, which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as revulsion. Because etymologically it means turning away, which you can sort of understand. Seeing in this way, the informed noble disciple becomes revulsed with the eye. But I think this is really not very. It doesn't work for me to translate in that way. It's too negative.
The disenchanting, because it you remind me of a spell, you know.
Yeah,
no longer under the spell.
No longer
under an illusion about what the nature of his experience was.
That's it. Yeah, that's the way I understood disenchanted. No longer under the spell of reactivity connected with sense experience.
Mm-hmm. So moving more from a particularly. That were captured state to an uncaptured state that was not necessarily pleasant or painful, but just
but liberated from the kind of unthinking, reactive involvement that keeps on creating problems. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep going, if that's all right, because I'm going to go into some of the background to we've been talking about like the Buddha's recommended response, as it were, disenchantment, dispassion, liberation. So I'd like to start by just mentioning that the Theravadin commentary on this adds, on this discourse, adds that before giving this discourse, the Buddha thought what might be an appropriate Dharma talk for these people who tend the sacred fire in the mornings. And he came to the conclusion, I will teach them about the six senses and their objects, comparing them to what is burning and blazing. And in this way, they will be able to obtain arahantship. And then the Buddha spoke this formulation of the Dharma in order to teach the Dharma to these people. So usually the Theravadin commentary is a bit dry and literal. But in this case, I think it's very helpful. It points out that this particular discourse was delivered to a particular group of people, fire worshippers, so that the Buddha tailored what he was saying to a particular group to meet their interests and preoccupations. So this is an example of what the later tradition called the Buddha's skillful means, his ability to teach appropriately. And the fire-worshipping ascetics, they believed that tending the sacred fire, performing fire rituals in the morning, pouring on ghee onto the fire, and all that, was the way to salvation. And the Buddha gets their attention by saying, everything is burning, everything is on fire. It's the kind of thing they'd be thinking about anyway, they'd be thinking about the importance of fire. And you can imagine, I think we have to imagine this as we're hearing it, that these fire-worshipping ascetics would have responded by saying, or at least thinking, no, it isn't. It's not that everything's on fire. It's just this, it's only my sacred fire that's burning. Why should everything be on fire? Do you see what I mean? The Buddha's getting their attention by a sort of rhetorical device. but he's got their attention. So then he has to, then the Buddha has to deliver, of course. So he has to explain what is supposedly burning and what is on fire. And what follows then is another analysis of the contents of experience. So those of you who were here last week might remember that we saw the Buddha using the framework of the five constituents or khandhas or aggregates for analysing the whole of human experience. But in this discourse he uses another framework, which I personally prefer, I have to say. So there are five sense organs plus the mind. There's the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, which is quite a big sense organ, and then the mind, which as it were receives information from the other sense organs, but remembers the past and future, well, remembers the past, imagines the future, thinks about what's going on. And the mind senses, as it were, all its thoughts that kind of come and go in some ways. So there's the five senses plus the mind. There's the objects of the five senses. There's what is seen, what the Buddha calls visual forms. Then there's sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles. We don't really have a word, do we, for objects of the body sense. That, like, the temperature is tangible, isn't it? Or the feeling of, I've got the floor under my feet, but you've got whatever's underneath you, that tangible experience.
Sensations?
Tangible sensations. Yeah, physical sensations. Well, sensations is a big word.
It is. Yeah.
But sensations often we use for tangible physical experience. And then we've got what the mind experiences, which is what's happening in our minds. And our hearts, in a way. It's quite important to that emotions are counted here as contents of experience, the things that go on for us. The Buddha goes a bit further than just saying that there's the senses plus their objects. He says there's also sense consciousness. There's also the contact between the senses, including the mind, and the world. And there's also the experience arising from contact, experience which is pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, as he says, which means somewhere in between. And I find this fascinating because elsewhere the Buddha asks, is there anything else apart from this everything? Is there anything else arising, anything else in experience apart from all this? So, in a way, it's very reasonable and sensible to believe that there's a world independent of our senses. I'm not wanting to get into making you think anything else but that. But then again, all we ever have to go on is our sense experience, yeah, including our thoughts and beliefs, which are objects of the mind, you could say. They're thoughts. So this is it. What is seen, what is heard, smelled, tasted, touched, and thought is the whole world for us. This is what the Buddha's... this is the implication. Once you start using this analysis, anything else is an idea in our minds. But of course, ideas are in our minds. So the Buddha's characterized the whole world, or we probably best to say the whole world of experience. So he said that everything, the whole world of our experience, is burning. But now comes the twist. It turns out, he's talking to these fire-worshipping ascetics, that he's using the word burning in a metaphorical sense. It's not that it's really in flames. Rather, the whole of our experience is on fire with compulsion, hostility and confusion. Yeah, this is what he said. So now we're on to exploring what on earth is he getting at there. So this analysis, compulsion, hostility, confusion. So it's usually translated greed, hate, and delusion. So greed, compulsion, hate, hostility, delusion, confusion. These are all translations of underlying Pali words, raga, dosa, moha. This list of three, like the three bad guys in the Buddhist movie, really. They're a very common way of talking about what psychologically is always a problem for human beings. What are their three basic psychological afflictions? So compulsion and hostility are emotional, you could say. They're the emotional drive towards experience, attraction, and aversion away from experience. Whereas confusion is an intellectual kind of affliction, our inability to get what's happening in our lives. So the early Buddhist texts, they always stress that awakening or nirvana is the ending of compulsion, hostility, and delusion, or confusion. In a way, you could say that's what awakening is. Although I think it's preferable, really, to say that, to put it in a positive way, to say that awakening is also characterised as, in terms of contentment, love, and wisdom, which is like the positive counterparts of compulsion, hostility, and confusion. So to say everything is burning with the fires of hostility, confusion, I'm getting confused now, compulsion, hostility, confusion, is a way of putting the Dharma. It's a way of putting ways of talking about the Dharma, which we find in other discourses that you might have come up against in other contexts. It's a formulation of the Dharma. And the real question is, does it speak to us? Does it speak to us at all? So I once lived in this men's community up in Lancaster with these three guys, lovely men, two cats and a dog. A lot of dope smoking went on in this house. It was some time ago. We had a great time together. And one of the men was obsessed with sex. Whatever one might say to him, yeah, it came round to sex. It was kind of crazy, really. So if you mentioned beds, well, obviously that's the problem. Beaches, lawns, woods, floors, bicycles, breakfast, dinner, tea. It all triggered these compelling ideas of various sorts of sexual activity in my friend's mind. So it was, everything was burning for him, really, with a specific kind of compulsion. Don't know if you ever come across, I mean, it could be something else, couldn't it, apart from sex, that people seem just obsessed with. So then there was the mother of a dear friend of mine, not obsessed with sex. Any topic of conversation one might bring up was an opportunity to be gloomy. So I was visiting with my friend, and we'd been to the park. So I said, you know, to make conversation as you do with your friend's mother, "The park here in town is very big, isn't it?" To which the response came, "Oh, the parking in town is terrible, terrible." Everything was burning for her, wasn't it? With a particular sort of gloominess. Can you burn with gloom? Not really.
Smouldering.
Yes. It's a bit smouldery.
Very ashy-like.
There's different kinds of burning, aren't there? So, actually, this is the time to mention T.S. Eliot, if you're up for it. So in the fire sermon, I don't know if you're familiar with The Wasteland, this long early modernist poem. It's a real hodgepodge of different images strung together. That's kind of it's what we mean by saying it's a modernist poem. It's drawn from lots of different sources that were present to Eliot's mind, and he weaves them into a kind of picture of the modern mind as being kind of caught up in various contents, but without a narrative anymore. And the end of the section called the Fire Sermon has, "To Carthage then I came, burning, 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 burning." And this is a reference to St. Augustine, who in his Confessions admits to, he's obsessed with sex actually. So he ended up going to Carthage where I can't remember exactly what happened in Carthage. But he converts to Christianity at a certain point and starts to find his way to salvation. So this is in Augustine's Confessions, 5th century Christian document. Eliot himself was somebody, he'd suffered a nervous breakdown some years before, and a bit of The Wasteland that I remember being struck by was these lines, "On Margate Sand, I can connect nothing with nothing." So he'd gone to Margate, of all places, to recover from his nervous breakdown. And in those days, it was a busy seaside resort, I suppose. And people would walk up and down the promenade. And he gets across as, "I can connect nothing with nothing." His mind was unable to find meaning in what he saw. This is like, I suppose, the contents of his mental state at that time. And I was thinking that perhaps it was this experience that for him led him to read the Fire Sermon as somehow evoking his experience. That not being able to connect up his experience into a meaningful sort of life was a sort of version of burning, everything burning. Burning with a lack of meaning, as it were. I'm not sure that quite works metaphorically. It's more like the opposite, isn't it? It's almost like totally without any fire of meaning. It's like a burning with cold, almost.
I actually, if I think something's burning, it's got two connotations, but one is that if somebody said to me, for example, "The painting behind you is positively on fire,"
yeah,
I would say that's quite a positive thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it is. It's beautiful. It's almost on fire. It's so vivid. That's how, one way in which I would interpret it.
And we say that, don't we? Somebody is on fire. That means perhaps they're improvising on the saxophone. Yeah, they're inspired.
Say somebody's burnt out.
So I think T.S. Eliot was burned out. T.S. Eliot was burned out, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. I suppose what I'm trying to get at in bringing up Eliot and my friend and all the rest of it is that, in a way, a discourse like this from 2,500 years ago, supposedly given to a bunch of fire-worshipping ascetics, we need to make our own connections with what's being said. There's not some sort of truth here we have to sort of take on board quite literally. It's more like we need to kind of connect with what's being suggested here.
Well, sort of translating it for myself, I suppose, one way I could put it is that to say that things are alive with hatred, or alive with aversion, or alive with confusion. There's quite an active sense of, like Eliot, wandering around, thinking, I can't connect anything with anything here. You know, it's quite an alive sense of confusion.
Yeah, that's it. He's got it. It's an alive sense of confusion.
It's alive with
living
these things. Yeah.
If I remember rightly, in The Wasteland, there's
there's a lot of sections about the aridity of the world they're walking through, kind of thing, and it's burned out in that sense as well. It's like a desert, isn't it, without water. There's no water here, you know. That's kind of one of the verses, I think, is about that. So
yeah.
I think it's a parched, kind of meaningless landscape, you know. I think maybe that's part of what he's getting at as well with his fire. But.
So you could imagine the Buddha speaking to Eliot, saying something like, Eliot, everything is parched. Yeah? Parched with what? Parched with compulsion, with hostility and confusion. It's a bit preachy, isn't it? But that's he said it better himself, basically, didn't he?
But then there's a bit later on in the poem when the rains come.
Yeah. Mm. It's not an entirely unhappy poem, is it?
No, it does have a sort of a happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty miserable.
It's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be an attempt to render a certain sort of desiccated world, isn't it? So, this talk of maybe being alive to confusion or burned out with perhaps compulsion. And so on. To my mind, brings up that an underlying truth that sense experience, this everything that the Buddha talks about, it isn't just what happens to us; it's how the world appears as a result of our active involvement with it. In a way, the desiccated appearance of the world in Eliot's poem is to do with how he's relating to what's going on. So the world shows up according to what we want, what we care about, what we believe, according to the quality of our attention. So these days, we might not be fire worshippers, but a lot of us pay attention to the news that it's as it's represented on the internet. And it's quite easy to pay a lot of attention, not only to the news, but to people's opinions about the news. Yeah? And what we end up with then is not so much that the world is burning, but the world is a drama. I'm very keen on this kind of way of putting it. The world of our experience is a constant drama driven by the plot lines of compulsion and hostility and confusion. It can look like the world is that way. But a lot of that is to do with how we pay attention to the purveyors of drama, as it were. So what happens when we notice all this and we begin to pay attention not to the contents of our experience but to how it shows up for us? So not to the contents but to the structure, as it were. And actually noticing that we ourselves have a part to play in this is the first step. We're kind of responsible for how we pay attention to our worlds. And it's if everything reminds you of sex, let's say, or everything is gloomy, or the world is really going to the dogs, it's obvious from the news, it tells us about our own psychological tendencies, I suppose, as much as it does about anything else. Of course, we're talking here about deep-rooted psychological habitual tendencies that each of us has some variation on that we're going to be familiar with. But they can change. I think that's the premise of Buddhist practice. They can change. And we see that represented here in the insight section of this discourse, where the monk, the Buddha, says to the monks that seeing in this way that everything is burning, or everything is gloomy, or everything is a massive drama, the informed noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and mind. The spell that's cast by our own psychological tendencies can loosen up a bit, even if it doesn't break entirely. We can find some room to manoeuvre. And that process, if it continues, leads to dispassion or self-possession, and then finally to liberation. And I've included, just at the end of the handout, some verses from another place in the Pali Canon, which I think nicely suggest a connection between the Buddha's obvious, he obviously likes this metaphor of everything being on fire, but he connects it here with Buddhist practice. So these are some verses. So they, as it were, the verses in the Pali Canon, you can imagine people would remember them as helpful reminders. So, those who practice day and night the teaching of the perfectly awakened one, they put out the fire of compulsion, constantly noticing unattractiveness. That doesn't mean that the world is unattractive. It means that if you pay attention to its quality of not all being sexually desirable, yeah, for instance, it gets to calm down a bit. Unattractiveness in the world is just part of how the world appears. And if you pay attention to that, a tendency to compulsion calms down. And he goes on to say, those excellent people put out the fire of hostility through kindness, which is to say, metta, and the fire of confusion through the wisdom that leads to piercing through. So here we see the Buddha characterising the three psychological tendencies, compulsion, hostility, confusion, and offering sort of antidotes, attending to, not attending to what keeps you compelled, and then attending to metta, that was a great antidote to hatred, and cultivating wisdom as an antidote to confusion. And finally, those mature beings, having put out the fires, indefatigable day and night, means they keep going, are completely quenched, remainderless. They have entirely overcome suffering. I mean, in a way, these verses, they preserve a whole lot of poetic diction, which are quite hard to capture in translation. But I'm hoping you get the point there. That this metaphor of things being on fire, the Buddha seemed to be quite keen on it. He used it beyond just talking to fire worshipping ascetics, perhaps to do with in the Buddha's day, the sacred fire being sort of quite alive in people's imagination as being something that is worshipped. So whether or not that works for us, it might be possible for us to feel into the imagery, as it were, to see the underlying kind of message and translate it into our own terms. That's the great thing about seeing these discourses, I think, as skillful means that worked in their time, as it were. It gives us permission to read these discourses as possibly useful for ourselves. Okay, I think I'll just stop there. Thanks very much. Yeah.